All right, welcome back to another episode of The Occasionalist. Matt Pagel here once again, flying this ship solo as we continue our first week of The Occasionalist Daily for this whole month. So we've already covered the NFL, we've already covered college football, we've covered baseball. And actually, I do want to make one clarification. I was a little bit wrong when I was talking about... I was talking about a graphic that had launch angle, and I think I had stated that it was between minus 10 and plus 10 degrees off parallel was like I guess you could call it like the cone of like these super high batting averages, and it's actually minus 10 degrees to positive 20 degrees. So like that 30 degree range, if you hit a ball within that 30 degree range, that like your batting average is like 450 or something like that. So. A little bit incorrect, but the spirit of the idea was still the same, basically. I was just a little bit incorrect when I was trying to recall the graphic that I had seen. But it was minus 10 degrees up to 20 degrees positive for this range of hitting that's if you hit a ball at that angle, at one of those angles, you know, at either, even down to the extreme of either one, you're probably hitting it pretty hard. So anyway, just slight clarification. But as we have been doing all week... Start this off with a little on this day kind of trivia deal. So on this day, March 7th, 1955, the musical Peter Pan starring Mary Martin was broadcast on NBC as part of the Producers Showcase series, and it attracted a then record 65 million viewers. That is pretty nuts. Even, you know, I know that like there weren't many channels back then, but to think that there were 65 million, at least 65 million households that had, or should say there were 65 million television sets in 1955 is kind of astounding as well. But that's March 7th, 1955. The Peter Pan musical on NBC attracts a record 65 million viewers. That's a lot of viewers. All right, so let's get into this episode. Again, Thursday, March 7th, 2024. We're just going to be talking the NBA's problems here. I think this is the obvious problem here is actually, I'm going to have like a little bit of a tie-in to the less obvious problem. But the obvious problem here is load management, right? And I'm not suggesting that it's load management is, I'm not one of those people that is going to compare NBA players to steel mill workers or whatever Charles Barkley has done in the past. And if most of these NBA players had their choice, they would play every single game, right? They would play every single game, almost every single minute if they had their way. It's the people who are paying them $40, $50 million a year. That's why they're sitting out, because the owners, the front office, and the coaches have a vested interest in keeping them healthy for as long as possible, especially for playoff runs. As we've seen more and more in the NBA, the regular season, I want to say the regular season doesn't matter, but you could almost look at the regular season as just an extended warm-up for the playoffs. And obviously these teams want to keep their prized players as healthy as long as possible. And if that means they sit out an extra game, extra game or two per month, or two or three games per month, then that's what they'll do. And I know the NBA has tried to combat this with, like, you know, you can't be an all-NBA player if you don't play at least, like, 65 games or 70 games or something like that. You can't win certain awards if you don't play X amount of games. Whatever. I think that's a little bit stupid, but... And believe me, none of these players are necessarily motivated by... Well, shit. Unless it's in their contracts, obviously. None of these players are motivated by making an all-NBA team. Unless there's some kind of financial incentive to make an all-NBA team. No one's, you know, none, even the top defensive players aren't fretting over, you know, not being eligible for the defensive player of the year. They're worried about getting paid money. Sounds cynical, but, you know, it's true. So, and whenever any of the old heads complain about, you know, players being soft nowadays that, you know, back in the day, Jordan played all 82 games or whatever. I mean, okay, fine, but look at the differences in the games now versus, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. It is a much more dynamic, intense, athletic game than it's ever been before. You know, the days of the plotting big man are over. Everyone can run, jump out of the gym. Everyone looks like a freak athlete now. It's just a very different game. It's just sort of like complaining that, it really is the equivalent, or close to it, not exactly, but the equivalent of complaining about, oh, well, you know, pitchers back in the day, they threw 300 innings. Well, yeah, they also weren't throwing 100 miles an hour back then. You know, it was rare that you found, you know, it was very, very rare that, you know, a guy like Bob Feller, there was really only one Bob Feller in all of baseball, a guy who was legitimately throwing 95 miles an hour plus, you know, pitch one through pitch like 100. Yeah. So those types of players back in the day didn't really exist, whereas now everyone throws that hard. And it is taxing on your body to throw that hard. We can talk about whether that's a good thing or not a good thing, but that's the equivalent to me, is complaining about the way things, when the game was less demanding physically, you know, trying to compare it to today's NBA, where the game is more demanding physically and everyone is a freak athlete and everyone is fast and everyone can run and jump, blah, 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 blah. So I really hate it when old heads get into that. And you know, it does suck. Like if you were you know, hoping to see one of your favorite players on a different team, you know, you're hoping for that one time that Victor Wembanyama is going to come to, you know, I don't know, Atlanta or Cleveland or whatever this season. And if he's sitting for load management, well, you know, that blows your chance to see him up close, right? Like, I get that. And it really does suck. And I wish there was a way to kind of lessen this impact. I mean, I guess there is. If we were to cut like six, eight games or whatever off the regular season, that way, then you have, you know, basically there's like an extra 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks of days off. Plus, you know, plus if you still were going to sit a player, you might only sit them once or twice throughout the entire season. So, I mean, that's a possibility, but I'm going to go ahead and guess that. Team owners are not willing to give up 6 to 8 games of revenue. Call me crazy. I just don't think they're going to be willing to do it. So, you know, I don't know what I don't have a solution to this. I just think that it's just the natural evolution of basketball. When you're paying individual players, you know, $35, $40, $50 million. I feel like Jaylen Brown is making $50 million this year. Or he's making like 45 and like Steph Curry's making 50. I don't know. I should have looked this up, but you have a vested interest as their owners to like, hey, you know what? If your knee's feeling just a little bit sore, then you're not going to play today because I can't have a $45 or $50 million investment getting injured or even just missing, you know, if it's one game and then you're good to go. Great. We've missed you for one game, but if that injury becomes worse and you miss 2 weeks, you know, that, like, I get it. I understand it from that standpoint. And if these guys weren't making this much money, I'm not sure that you would see teams kind of handle them with such kid gloves. It's just because the salaries have gotten so high for star players, it just makes sense that you want to protect that investment more. And I'm not saying this is not like a pro management sort of message. I just think this is reality. That's all. All right, so let's get into the less obvious problem. The first less obvious problem. Oof, that sounded terrible, but I'm going to keep going. The NBA has, amongst its youngest players, the NBA has too many project players. And I mean project players, guys that are very, very far from being NBA ready. More and more top draft picks are just simply not prepared to play in the NBA. And I guess, you know, to a degree, you know, by definition, a lot of these players aren't necessarily prepared to play in the NBA, but they really are very, very far off from having at least the rudimentary skills to compete every day in the NBA. And that's why you're seeing a lot of like high draft picks really, like, you know, they might have like really great highlights, and, you know, in their rookie years, you know, just thinking about Scoot Henderson and, I can't remember the kid from a couple years ago, a kid from Houston that was, I believe he was a G League. He was on the G League Ignite and he got drafted out of, I can't remember why his name isn't coming to me right now, but I'm sure it'll come to me later. But you'll see that they have good highlights, but all they have are a few highlights. They were not in like regular rotations to begin the season because they could not defend at an NBA level. They could not get into NBA sets and NBA plays in an appropriate manner. They were very, very raw, like more raw than you would expect for players who have been playing basketball at a very high level for quite literally, the past like 10, 12 years. There are just more and more of these guys like this. And this is all goes back to the AAU system. If you're unfamiliar, the AAU system is just youth amateur basketball, right? And there's different levels to it. I think when you get real young, it's like the EYBL, maybe. I can't remember. But the AAU is more when you're thinking about kids who are like more high school aged. I think it even stretches to middle school as well. But regardless, that's neither here nor there. But the AAU system is youth kind of private basketball. And it is funded in part by various shoe companies. In fact, a lot of people refer to it as the shoe leagues. For youth basketball. And the problem with the AAU system, there's sort of two huge problems here. And the biggest one is that the AAU system values individual players over team. These players jump from team to team, sometimes on the same weekend. An AAU, like, you know, so just to give you an example here, like let's just say there's an AAU tournament in Vegas. It's where a lot of them are. Like a big AAU tournament will be in Vegas, and these kids will play like five or six games on the weekend, like a Thursday through Sunday. They'll play like five or six games, and if one of those teams gets eliminated on, let's just say that one team gets eliminated on Thursday after losing a couple of games, you will have players jump ship to another team on Friday because, the team has advanced and they're going to have a better chance. And they'll tell you flat out, they'll tell these coaches flat out, well, I'm going to have a better chance to showcase myself on this team anyway. And that seems ludicrous to me. And I think it's, I don't want to pound the sand and like say that like, oh, it was better. Things were better before player empowerment in the NBA, but because certainly things were not better before player empowerment, but this sort of bizarre entitlement, I guess. I don't know if that's the exact word I'm looking for, but this maybe this bizarre sort of putting yourself so far first really does hurt. It really does hurt how players develop when the individual player has to be the thing versus the team being the thing. And I say that, again, I say this because when you are a part of a team, you have to learn how to play, like, especially a sport like basketball, which is very, very, the longer you can play with one team, the better that team gets as a team, right? Like, you become more familiar with how someone's gonna, when someone comes off a screen, for a three-pointer or something, the only way that you get to know where that guy likes the ball is by playing more games with him. So, or her. So when someone's curling off that screen, lining up for a three-pointer, do they want a bounce pass? Do they want a pass up high? Is it, it's that kind of stuff. It's, when a play breaks down, the teammates that have played together a long time will figure out what one should do in the course of a play breaking down. When you don't have this, when teams are very fluid, and we're more concerned about showcasing, how high someone can jump and how hard they can dunk, they're not getting any sort of team skills developed. They're not developing any team skills. They're not developing any of the other stuff that makes a more complete basketball player. So that's like the biggest problem. The next biggest problem kind of goes along with this idea of the individual over the team. As I mentioned, you'll go for a weekend in Vegas for like five or six games. They don't practice in the AAU. They do not practice or rarely ever practice. If you're not practicing, how can you get better at playing defense? How can you get better at passing? How can you get better at rebounding? How can you get better at shooting? Everything. How can you get better at it if you're not practicing? In European basketball, so just again, keep this in your mind. AAU basketball, they'll play 5 or 6 games in a weekend. Sometimes these kids, in the course of let's say a spring AAU season, will play like 50 or 60 games. In a lot of Euro youth leagues, European youth leagues, they will play one game a week and practice 5 days a week. Let that sink into your brain. They will play one game a week and they will practice 5 days a week. So if you were to kind of take the same kind of calendar, a European youth league, and I wish I had an easy European youth league comparison here, but whatever. Let's just say that there's, whatever the AAU equivalent in Europe is. While the American kids might play 50 or 60 games in a couple of months, the European kids on their AAU circuit will play 10 games, 20 games tops. That's it. I'm sure they have tournaments and things towards the end of their season. But they understand that if you want to become a better basketball player, you have to work on all aspects of being a good basketball player. And the only way that you can do that, and also work on the stuff that makes you a better teammate, and the only way you can do that is to practice over and over and over again. There is a reason why the European players come over to the United States, and they, even if they're not superstars, they almost always readily fit into teams with almost minimal effort, because they know what it's like to. Because their whole lives have been predicated on perfecting some of the smaller details. So those things that they need, they're ready to practice. They're ready to go to work and practice and work on the small things because they have been their whole lives. Whereas the AAU circuit kids in the United States have not been doing that their whole lives. They are not good at, they're not good at practicing. One of the things that I always loved about, in terms of the Kobe stories, was how Kobe would, practices for Kobe were like he made certain people's lives miserable in practice, because Kobe knew that this is where you were going to work stuff out. This is how the team was going to get better, was going after each other in practice and making it difficult on each other. To kind of extend it outside of the NBA, I remember when Pete Carroll was at USC, and to a man, if you ask the USC players about Pete Carroll's practices, they were hard. They were hard. They were going after each other. They were difficult practices. And they knew it's because, if we're going after each other full go in practice, then the game is going to be easy, because we're the best team in the country. So if we're giving each other our best, then it doesn't matter what happens on Saturday, because no one else can compete with our best. And that was the whole idea. Make practice difficult so the games are easy. And it's really difficult to develop any skills and develop that sort of game time. I'll call it the game time mentality, that everything that we just put into action, we're it's going to translate here in the court. This is how we're going to do it. We just went through, several nightmare practices. The game is going to be easy. Well, if you don't have any of those and you just play games, then how can you ever develop that certain mental edge? How can you ever develop those good habits? I just don't think you can. So those are the two biggest problems, the individuality and just this idea that they barely ever practice. But to tie this real quickly back into my obvious issue with the NBA, the load management issue. As I mentioned, some of these AAU circuits, these kids will play a ton of games in a short period of time. Plus, a lot of these AAU circuits are year-round, so you'll have kids playing, it's spring, summer, and then possibly for their own high school. So you'll essentially be playing basketball year-round. I think that this year-round grind, starting at age 14, and in some cases younger, this is why we're seeing so many severe injuries in the NBA at guys who are, in their mid-20s, mid to late 20s, that this year-round grind, these players are coming into the NBA with so much mileage on their legs already. And you certainly don't notice it as much, with young guys. I know when I was younger, I could do just detestable things to my body and be ready a day later. But it does accumulate. And I think this is why we're seeing guys with like severe why guys get severe hamstring tears, why guys get like these weird muscle tears that like we really never, I mean, again, it also goes back to the idea of like the sport being more dynamic than it ever was before. But if you are essentially wearing your body out before you ever played a minute of NBA basketball, and then you're asked to do something even more intense and dynamic, your body at some point, the accumulation of this punishment is just at some point going to become too much for you. So I do think that the year-round AAU grind is causing more injuries later on for NBA players. Thus, it's leading to more and more teams doing overt load management of their star players. Okay, so let's move on to the next problem here. And I am going to sound a little bit like the old man yelling "Get off my lawn." The other problem I think the NBA is facing is analytics, and I am a person that is very, very in favor of analytics, especially with baseball. Give me as much data as possible to inform my general decision making. But I think in the NBA, it's ruining gameplay, but it does make it very stilted in some games, and it really shows up in some games. This idea of what teams should be doing based on analytics. So, just real quickly, and this is just going to be from the offensive side. The data says the two most efficient shots in the NBA are a dunk or a layup. Obviously, you're right next to the hoop, right next to the rim, or a three-pointer. So, are these necessarily? These are the two most efficient shots. Are these necessarily the best shots? No, they are not necessarily the best shot. I take that back. A dunk and a layup is always the best shot except for like very, very particular circumstances. Does this idea of going for the two most efficient shots, does this remove a lot of the context around the flow of an offense on any given night? Yes, it does. You might be able to exploit a matchup, and teams are usually pretty good at this. If a big man is having an easy time with an opponent's big man, you will see the ball get inside to him a little bit more. Conversely, if a team is just can't seem to miss from three point range, you will see the offense kind of shift to then obviously favor the 3-point shot. But I think overall, this is kind of, especially the three-pointer, I think overall this is sort of a little bit of fool's gold here. And I think we're also kind of, we exist in the era of Steph Curry, a guy who can make three-pointers from literally anywhere on the court. And we're seeing Caitlin Clark as well, the college women's side, a woman who can make shots from literally anywhere on the court as well. We're kind of getting fooled into the idea that that any NBA player can just, that this is the norm, that any NBA player can do this with ease. And there is data that completely suggests otherwise. So let me get to that real quick. So this is the league-wide NBA three-point percentage by decade, starting in the 1980s and then obviously moving up to so far in the 2020s. So in the 1980s, they were, when they started charting this, there were 18,942 games played. The three-point percentage was 28.9%. And this essentially was on, and this is hysterical, this is essentially one made three-pointer. This is per team, basically. There was one made three-pointer per team on 3.5 attempts. That's all they took essentially collectively in the 1980s. But then we see a jump in the 1990s, right? 21,868 games played in the 90s. The 3-point shooting percentage jumps to 34.7, and this is four made three pointers on 11.4 three pointers attempted per game. Jump another decade to the 2000s. 24,190 games played. Field goal percentage goes up slightly, 35.6%. I should say 3-point percentage goes up slightly, 35.6%. And this is on 5.6 made three-pointers, and 15.7 attempted per game. How about the 2010s? 24,118 games played. Shooting percentage stays exactly the same, 35.6. And this is on, and this, now we're starting to see a pretty interesting change here. This is on 8.2 made three-pointers per game and 23.1 attempted per game. And that's in the 2010s. In the 2020s, so far this decade, 11,042 games played, 36.1% is the three-point shooting percentage. And this is on 12 made three-pointers per game, 12.5, on 34.6 attempts from three-point range per game. That's a lot of threes. So literally from the 2020s to the 19, from the 1980s to the 2020s, literally we were attempting 10 more shots per 10 more three-pointers, 10 times the amount of three-pointers per game. 3.5 attempts in the 1980s, 34.6 in the 2020s. So what am I bringing up here? What's the point exactly? My point is that you can see, sure, like after the 1980s, we get more three-point specialists and we get, you know, more people familiar with the three-point shot, right? Like guys just become better at it. Hence why there's a 6% percentage jump from the 1980s to the 1990s. However, it really doesn't change much after that, suggesting that the fact that we're taking more and more of these efficient shots. So here, just real quickly. So the 1990s, their three-point percentage, 34.7. 2000s, 35.6. 2010s, stays exactly the same, 35.6. 2020s, we have a slight increase, a half percentage point increase, 36.1. So again, it suggests that, yes, this shot is more efficient, but however, NBA players aren't any better at making them than they have been in the past 30 years. The only big jump, and again, the only big jump is from the 1980s, and that's because we just didn't have any of the specialists who can make three-pointers at a much higher percentage. I think, I want to say Kyle Korver one year led the NBA in three-point percentage at like 54%, right? But he is such an anomaly in that regard. The same way that Steph Curry is an anomaly, that his preferred shot really is a three-point shot. Those are just anomalies. Whereas the average player clearly isn't that great at shooting three-pointers. They're really not any better than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or 30 years ago. I have some additional kind of funny shit for this. So, you know, as good as we've been at shooting the three-pointer, as you know, even though we've gotten better over the decades by very slight margins, pretty much collectively the worst three-point shooting percentage games have all been within, let me just do a quick double check here, the worst percentage three-point shooting games have all been in the last 8 years. I'll just do the top three here. So the worst three-point shooting percentage game was the New York Knicks on New Year's Eve, 2020, against the Toronto Raptors. So this must have been in, I guess, were we still do? No, we were done with the bubble then. I was just thinking, yeah, we were done with the pandemic. Well, we weren't done with the pandemic, but possibly this could have been the year that the Raptors played their games in Florida, I think. Anyway, doesn't matter. But the Knicks lost to the Raptors 83-100, and their three-point shooting percentage was 8.3. They made, we got a side scroll here real quick. I got a side scroll again. This stupid chart isn't as big as I would like. But they attempted 36 three-pointers. 36 three-pointers. And, excuse me, and if you know what the percentage of 8.3 out of 36 is, they made three. Three. They made three three-point field goals in a game. You can't tell me that it wouldn't have behooved them to come inside the three-point line and maybe attempt a couple more shots. I think it might have. The Houston Rockets in 2016, and this was, I believe, the 2016 Rockets. This was with like Harden and some other, possibly Eric Gordon, some other like big time 3-point shooters. But they had a game in which they went 8.6 from 3-point range on 35 attempted 3-pointers, which makes them, that means they made three as well. And then the third one down here, also the Houston Rockets. From 2021, let's see, February 28th, 2021, against the Memphis Grizzlies, a game in which they lost, mind you, by 49 points, they attempted 45 three-pointers for a total shooting percentage, three-point shooting percentage of 8.9%. 45 three-pointers attempted, 8.9%, which means they made four out of those 45. So, again, is it the most efficient shot? Yeah, in a bubble, it is one of the most efficient shots. But in reality, in the flow of the game, if you are just going by the numbers, by the analytics, you are going to come up short without understanding the flow of the game and the context of what an offense is doing or not doing. It should have sunk in pretty quickly for the Rockets of 2021 that by shot 20, I'm assuming they didn't make their first four and then go 0 for 41 after that. But it should have sunk in pretty quickly that they were not hitting from three-point range and they need to try something else. Similarly, this always reminds me of this game. It was the West Conference Finals between the Warriors and the Houston Rockets, a series in which the Rockets should have beaten the Warriors. Chris Paul got injured, pulled his hamstring, didn't play in the final game, and I guess that's part of it. However, it's not like they got blown out. They lost 101-92. And in fact, they had the lead early. They were up by like 10 or 11, I think, at half. But I'm just pulling up the stats from this game because I remember watching this game and thinking to myself, what an absolute pathetic non-adjustment that they made here. So this Rockets team was they shot a lot of threes, right? They shot a ton of threes. They had, besides Chris Paul, they also had... Eric Gordon. They also had James Harden, Trevor Ariza. They had more guys that shot from the outside. That's just how they were predicated. Perimeter ball movement, shooting the three. That's just like what they were doing. So, again, this is a team that lost by nine. And I remember this in the third quarter of this game. They got ice cold from three-point range, and they just never recovered. Let me pull this up real quick. The third quarter, they're outscored 33-15, and they just were bricking everything left and right from three-point range. Percentage-wise, 15.9%. They were 7 of 44. Also didn't help that they could not make a fucking free throw to save their lives, 13 out of 22. But anyway... 15.9% from three-point range. PJ Tucker, 2 out of 5. Ready for this one? Trevor Ariza, in 42 minutes played that game, 0 for 12 from the field, 0 for 9 from three-point range for 0 points. Eric Gordon, a noted sharpshooter, 2 out of 12. James Harden, one of the all-time three-point leaders, 2 out of 13. Let's see here, who else? Gerald Green looks like he went 1 for 4. So... again, just these are like sort of your big three scorers without Chris Paul. Your big three scorers from deep went a collective, say, 0 for 9, 2 for 12, 2 for 13. That's 4 for 25. That is 4 for 34. I'm not a mathematician, but that doesn't sound like peak efficiency to me. So I'll just wrap this one a little bit longer than I thought. So I'll just wrap it up by saying better things happen with NBA offenses when there is consistent movement towards the basket. And it also helps if you have bigs that have consistent mid-range threat. But consistent movement towards the basket opens things up more. It opens up three-pointers. It opens up mid-range shots. And I do sound a little bit, kind of get off my lawn. But when you do get to the playoffs in the NBA, teams clamp down defensively big time on the inside shot and the three-pointer, which leaves gaps in the mid-range to be exploited. Except that teams do not often practice shooting in the mid-range. Unless you have a couple of bigs that kind of shoot from that mid-range from like 18 to 15 feet. It's just not a way that offenses really work anymore. Unless someone just gets left wide open, you do not see many players taking shots from the mid-range. You know, DeMar DeRozan's like one of the last guys that really does it like this. You know, and there's some other guys that certainly more big men. You know, Joel Embiid can definitely hit threes and stuff, but he'll also take mid-range shots. Same with Jokic will take mid-range shots. It's usually the bigs now that have moved as the big man has moved farther away from the basket in the NBA over the years. It's the big men that have kind of filled that mid-range, but there's still room for any player to get open in this area, especially if there are just gaps in coverage, because it's really, in theory, should be a free 2 points. So I don't know. Call me old school, but that's just how I think that this analytic revolution in the NBA is kind of creating very stagnant offenses now, and leading to these teams. As I mentioned before, one of those games that the Rockets missed all those shots, they lost by like 50 points. And this is going to happen when you can't make a shot, because you're plugging away from, you know, you're plugging away from deep. You can't make any of those. You're going to get blown out. If you can adjust your offense to make a goddamn 2-pointer every now and then maybe you won't get blown out of games by 50 points. Just a thought, though. Just a thought. All right. So that wraps up this week's mini. Excuse me, not this week. That wraps up today's minisode for Thursday, March 7th. Stay tuned for our final minisode, our final problems, our sports problems minisode tomorrow, as we tackle soccer and hockey. All right, catch you on the flip side.